I mean, you're the soccer man.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all soccer people.
This is Roots Pod.
Let's see if they can find something on this set piece. Oh, look at that! And listen to the crowd! A dazzling goal for 20,000 to witness in jubilation!
Oh, welcome into Roots Pod. This is Aaron. On this particular episode, we've got the normal Chuckle Fucks, Peter and John, and we're joined by honorary Chuckle Fuck Jack, who occasionally writes for the blog.
Hello.
Last seen writing a more or less incendiary piece about how the game day experience had gotten to be a little unfun towards the end of the season. And he's with us today because he has done some reporting about the ongoing collective bargaining negotiations.
If you thought the front office was mad about what Jack had to say about the experience, wait till you see how they react to the labor negotiations.
Yeah, actually, what Jack is, he's sort of an AI creation of the rest of us who handles the most incendiary takes.
I am here to make your guys' relationship with them harder.
Great.
Great. Somehow that's a possibility.
I think we can get there.
Let's just get right into that. You spoke with Connor Tobin, correct? And he is head of the Players Association. What's his
He is the founding president of the USLPA.
Oh, right. Of course, because the USLPA is only a couple of years old.
It is three years old.
Landmark contract a couple of years ago, which is it up this off season?
It is up at December 31st.
Okay, so it's up in less than 2 months, and presumably we'll need a new one for next season even to happen. So we're going to get right into that, because... what point is there in talking about next season if we can't even say that next season is going to happen? Without further ado, here is Jack's interview with Connor Tobin.
All right. I am here with Connor Tobin. He is the executive director of the USL Players Association. Hi, Connor. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For some of our listeners who aren't familiar with the USLPA or kind of anything out, who are you? What's your role, and what does the USLPA do?
Yeah, the USLPA is the collective bargaining representative of all the players in USL Championship, USL League One, and USL Super League. So we're a labor union that represents players trying to fight for better conditions.
Awesome. So, I just kind of, for people who maybe aren't familiar, what is a day like for a USL championship player? We got a lot of Roots fans here. Like, what is as an employee, as a worker, what's it like going to work?
It depends what day it is and what's going on, but that could look anything from, you know, showing up for training in the morning, going through a session, grabbing lunch, going into a weight session in the afternoon, maybe you got an appearance, maybe travel days. You could be, you know, departing on a 6 a.m. flight. So it's early wake up call, airport, travel. Depending on where you're going in USL, that could be almost a full day of travel, training when you get there, try to get some sleep in before going and playing a match the next day. So work days for our guys can look a lot of different ways.
And do you think like those work days are kind of similar across Championship, League One, Super League? We're seeing like that daily grind is very similar across all these levels.
Yeah, I would say that it's similar. I think you get some variance between Championship and League One, maybe in terms of resourcing at the clubs and what that experience looks like. So maybe how you're supported from, you know, a medical point of view or some of these other things can change slightly. But quite honestly, one of the defining features of USL, whether it be Championship or League One, is the player experience can vary greatly from club to club to club to club. So it's really hard to say, like, this is exactly what that looks like. And that's actually one of the driving reasons around the formation of the USLPA was players saying, hey, as a player in one of these leagues, there should be some level of minimum standard from club to club and some level of expectation that you have as a professional player in that particular league.
Okay, so kind of jumping off of that, you guys have had, so this sort of disparity between clubs seems to be a big point of contention between in the bargaining sessions that you guys have had lately. Can you kind of cue us into how those bargaining sessions have been going and kind of what your core demands are and where the holdup has been?
Yeah, we've been at this a while. I think one of the things, you know, not just that there's variance between clubs, but the league structure, I don't think a lot of people have thought a ton about. It's unique. The fact that the league is a privately held company that is a franchisor. You know, I think a lot of people, when you think about, let's say NBA, you know, as a team owner, when I buy into the league, I kind of 1/30th of the league. You know, actually the league owners employ the commissioner. The commissioner's working on the team owner's behalf. That is different than our league. Those things are separate. They have different financial interests. So I think as it comes to bargaining, that makes for a much more complex environment.
Sounds like it.
We have been negotiating since August of 2024. We've had nearly 30 sessions. I think from a Players Association standpoint, our goals are pretty straightforward. It's trying to get to fair pay, employer provided healthcare, and just general professional standards. And when I say professional standards, again, it's trying to even out no matter what club you're at. Like, there's some minimum things that should be in place in terms of what the playing experience is.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any specifics with regards to negotiations that you can kind of let us know about here?
I guess there's a whole lot of different things that go into a collective bargaining agreement. A lot of standards. We're talking, you know, standards not just in terms of pay, but it might be, what does a grievance process look like? How equitable is that process? How efficient is that process? What do things look like from a medical point of view? For example, what right do you have as a player to a second medical opinion? So if a team doctor says, you know, X, Y, or Z should be the source of treatment, our guys, you know, our tools are our bodies, and, you know, guys usually have a fairly good sense of their body, and they may not agree with that. So what is your right to go get a second medical opinion? Who bears that cost? And then ultimately, if there's a differing opinion, what happens? So there can be a lot of process things and rights sort of things that, you know, that we're spending time at bargaining trying to get this kind of standards that create balance between the entities at the table.
So if I'm not totally mistaken here, it seems like a lot of this negotiation is almost more around professional standards and keeping players healthy and able to have a prolonged career, even more so than just the amount of money that players are being paid directly right now.
Yeah, I think it all kind of ties in together. I think one of the things that has been one of the features for lower division soccer is it hasn't been all that viable for all that many guys. So you see a huge amount of turnover where quality players are leaving the sport, quite honestly, because it's not sustainable for them or their families. One of the things from our point of view is that has a knock-on effect in terms of the standard of play on the field, the quality of the league, but also U.S. soccer in general. If we have an attrition of quality players who are leaving the sport, not because, hey, you know what, they're no longer at the level, or maybe, hey, their bodies have gotten older and can't sustain it. If they're choosing to leave because of economics or because of the conditions being so poor, like, that is problematic from what is the quality of this league. And quite honestly, that is a bigger question within U.S. soccer. If we're losing good players every year, you know, are we really progressing the standard of play?
So why do you think that burden has sort of fallen on the USLPA more than the league itself? Why are they not? Why does the health of the sport seem to not matter to them as much as it does in this regard, with regards to you guys, it does to you?
That's a pretty dynamic question. I think one of the things where we're at in terms of a sport right now is we're still in a growth phase. There's still a lot of money that needs to go into building the infrastructure of the sport. It's not as developed as other parts of the world. So that necessitates a balance between the league and the clubs and the players. All of this stuff needs to work in unison as this grows. You know, I think historically, if you look from a player point of view, even going back to when we formed in 2018, it felt like players were never really a part of the formal decision-making for a lot of the things that happened up until that point. So one of the focuses that we had when we formed as an organization trying to get to a first collective bargaining agreement was literally, hey, give us the right to sit at the table and formally speak into this because we've been frozen out of this. I think when we're sitting here this second time renegotiating a deal for a championship, a lot of what we're focused on is, hey, is the playing experience in balance with where the business is at currently? A collective bargaining agreement gives a forum for the parties to come to the table, try to find balance for where the business is at, and almost as importantly, say, hey, over the course of this agreement, what's the evolution, the pace of change of what that balance is as the business is hopefully developing?
Okay, cool. So if I can just kind of backtrack a little bit, you mentioned that the USLPA, you're in your second ever bargaining agreement or bargaining session with the USL right now.
For USL Championship. We're technically an umbrella organization, meaning that like League One players are a different bargaining unit. We have a agreement for them. And then, as I said, we're the representatives for USL Super League, but we don't yet have a CBA for that group.
Okay, so are you? There's a pending CBA for League One and for the Super League?
League One has a current agreement that'll run through 2027. Super League, we're gearing up to actually start negotiating our first ever CBA at that league.
Okay, cool. So I guess that kind of relates for the Super League, since they have already changed. They already have officially sanctioned themselves a Division One league, and the USL has announced a plan to put a league on top of the championship, essentially, and give themselves Division One status on the men's side as well. How does that affect these negotiations, and how does USL on one hand saying we are intending to make ourselves a first division league, and then on the other hand saying we will not provide the correct facilities and resources for our players to be first division players?
Yeah, one thing that's a little bit technical here, but I think it's important to understand, sanctioning is not provided to itself by USL. USL can pursue sanctioning, but it's ultimately US Soccer that has to grant that sanctioning. You know, as it relates to USL pursuing Division One status on the men's side with a new league, that is something that is in their purview as a business to pursue. Certainly, there will be an impact of that on the existing leagues, whether that's teams moving to that potential new league. Certainly, the economics around Pro Rel may change all of this. So from our perspective, you know, these big aspirational goals that USL set are fine and great, but the proof is in the pudding. And like that really matters from our point of view. And certainly that affects the standards that we're pushing for here and now. I think from our point of view, these things are great. It's great to have that ambition. But again, is that in balance with what the playing experience is now? And from our point of view, some of these things need to get addressed before we go tackle these bigger, ambitious, lofty goals.
That makes a ton of sense. What are you hoping that happens in the next bargaining session that hasn't happened in the previous ones?
I hope that we have a breakthrough and have the league and the clubs kind of get to the point of realizing, hey, this is where balance is, and let's actually start to talk in material terms about where that is. Right now, I think that the parties are very far apart, which is frustrating from our point of view, given that we're 14 months in. So I'm hoping at some point we have a breakthrough in terms of that conversation and getting closer to actually being in a place where we could strike a deal.
So you mentioned that it seems, despite 14 months, that things are still far apart. How on the table does it feel now that there is potentially a lock or a strikeout and or a strike? And maybe for some of our listeners who are unfamiliar, what's the difference between those two things?
Yeah, so our current collective bargaining agreement expires December 31st. What that means is the parties don't get a deal. It doesn't mean that you walk it right into a work stoppage. That's not at all where that means. It just means either party would gain the ability to instigate a work stoppage. If a work stoppage is instigated by the employers, meaning that they're the ones that say, hey, you cannot work. That's called a lockout. Traditionally, think about a factory, and it's literally the factory owner chaining the doors saying, hey, we're shutting down the factory until you guys concede and we get to a deal that is favorable from an owner's point of view. The opposite side of that is a work stoppage that's instituted by workers. So in that place, workers say, hey, we're not going to work till we have a fair deal. It's called a strike. And I think that's the one that, you know, people are more familiar with, where you have picket lines and things like that. You know, I really sincerely hope that we don't end up in that place. You know, I think we have a lot of distance to go before December 31st. And I hope that, you know, the leagues and clubs are a willing partner and actually trying to get to a deal, and we'll see where things land.
So what can our fan, what can US fans of USL clubs do to support you guys? We've seen some supporters groups with TIFOs and other stuff, but the games are over now. What can we tangibly do to help you guys between now and December 31st?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is pay attention. There's likely to be more conversation around this. Ask questions. I think it's generally tuning in. I think a lot of people show up to matches on Saturday night, and listen, a lot of people enjoy, you know, the sport and our players as a piece of entertainment. It's nice to come out on Saturday night and enjoy a beer and kind of be distracted and yell at the referees maybe or whatever it is. But there is a whole piece where this is a human pursuit. There are workers involved with this, and understanding, you know, there are things that we're pushing for that I think most people would view as, I would be surprised that that's happening. And hey, that's not what I would expect from a professional standard. And I think kind of tuning into that human experience is, I think, what we would ask.
Do you have any examples of kind of how those professional standards aren't being met in a way that you feel comfortable sharing?
Yeah, I mean, I think employer provided healthcare is a key one. Put yourself in the shoes of a player. Again, this is not all our clubs, but at certain clubs, maybe you're on a contract that is, you know, towards the back end of what the league is. You know, you're making 26,000-30,000 a year, but that's inclusive of your housing, and you don't receive health insurance. You're starting to make practical hand-to-mouth decisions about whether, hey, do I take that couple hundred bucks to go get a, you know, an ACH plan, or do I need that money to put food on my table or support my family or whatever that is? Think about the stress that comes with that. We're in a profession where our bodies are kind of the product, so to speak, and you know, your ability to go and perform in that. Again, then we think about downstream pieces, and while, you know, we would have coverage for any workplace injury through something like a workers' comp insurance, how efficient is those sorts of processes? We're dealing with a bunch of different state statutes. So even in some of those places, it's not all that efficient. How do you actually get back to being healthy, and how well are you supported in that process? And certainly from our perspective, there's a trickle effect to even what happens on the field on a Saturday night. This affects quality in the league.
Yeah, definitely. So you are a USL veteran, a retired USL player, if I'm not mistaken. What
is... If you want to call it that, I wouldn't say I was very good at all, but I hung on for far too long.
Well, what is retirement like for USL players? What is life after being a professional soccer player for the United Soccer League?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. I think, one, it's a challenge for any professional athlete. I don't care the level you've gotten to get to a place where you are pro, even at a USL standard, you have to have dedicated your life to this. That means your focus has really, for the most part, been singularly on this. A lot of your identity is tied up with that. And getting to a point where you're not doing something that you've done probably every day for 25, 30 years of your life is a huge change. And then the loss of that identity, that is in and of itself is challenging. I would argue that it's even more challenging for some of our guys transitioning out of playing at a USL level, because there are very, very, very limited resources in terms of supporting guys, in terms of programming to help people make that transition. And then we add in the fact that guys who spend their careers at this level aren't being compensated richly for this. Yeah, so like your
retirement is a rough word to use for this. Yeah.
Yeah. So the practical reality is like, hey, you've got to put your food on your table for your family. Like, and you don't necessarily have a runway to work through some of these things like you would if you were, you know, a Major League Baseball player or something like that and making this transition. I don't want to diminish maybe what those people go through, because I think that is challenging in its own right. But we certainly, I would define any sort of transition experience for people in the USL. It's a challenge, and we see it every year.
Yeah, transition is probably the right word, not retirement. It's a transition to a different work life. Okay, well, thanks so much for coming on. Is there anything important that you feel like you have to share with our audience, or just really to get out here?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, a lot of these things can be hard to think about. I get, again, a lot of people want to show up and be entertained, and maybe you don't want to think about these things. I think the piece that I would always ask people like that is, like, what is football, and, like, who makes football? For me, that answer is that football is nothing without players and without fans. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason that people should care about what's going on in these negotiations. This is about one set of those people, and how do we get to something that is sustainable for them so we can continue to grow the sport, continue to improve the sport. And quite honestly, then it comes back to the other set of people. It's the fans that are enjoying this. Like, how do we find balance where the people that most directly make this sport special are being put front and center in terms of the decision-making, the trajectory of where we go in the sport.
Yeah, our I would hope our soccer league would be prioritizing our soccer players.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for sitting down with me, Connor. It was really great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on, giving us your evening.
Yeah, no worries, Jack. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, so that was Jack and Connor Tobin. And Jack, let me just throw it to you. Sort of, what is your biggest takeaway from that conversation? I mean, the guys covered a lot of interesting ground there. What are you going to be looking for the most, I guess, over the next couple of months?
I think there's sort of like a big gap in like how USL sort of presents itself in terms of like their continuous growth model that they sort of present, and like how they treat the employees that are expected to like produce that continuous growth. So like there's been it feels like there's a big difference between like a league that's like the USL. One of the big disputes of their negotiations right now is they don't provide healthcare. Not every club is required to provide healthcare for their players, and most of the clubs don't. And so you're trying to be a Division I league, but at the same time, you're also fighting really, really hard to make sure that you don't have to provide healthcare for all of your players. Like, there's just a lack of seriousness there. It just feels kind of jarring going into this, like how unserious USL is about what it takes to be a Division I league, what that would mean.
Would you describe yourself, knowing what you know now about how these negotiations are going? And I mean, I guess full disclosure, I think most of what we have is labor side, right? I mean, most of that will be true pretty much forever, I think. Would you describe yourself as optimistic about these negotiations?
It's hard to come away super optimistic, I think. There are just some real basic, I mean, so a lot of labor negotiations come down to, I mean, basically like a matter of respect. And when you're so blatantly trying to grow the league so aggressively, but you're so unwilling to negotiate with your players, you're so willing to like, there are players that like, there are some teams don't have training facilities. There are players that like dress in their car, or they dress at home. They drive to training in their car, and then they train there, and then they drive home after that in their stuff. Like there's just a real lack of seriousness about what this expects. And kind of what a lot of this comes down to is like the USL has a very bizarre structure in comparison to like the rest of US sports. So like the four major US sports all have a model where there are 30 teams that collectively own the league. Essentially, if you own an NBA team, or if the, you know, you own 1/30 of the NBA, the commissioner works for the owners directly. If you own the NFL team, you own a 32nd of the NFL. The commissioner works for these owners. USL doesn't have that same structure. USL has like actual franchises. So there's the USL like corporate league structure, but then each individual club is like its own franchise, like the way that like a fast food restaurant would have a franchise. So what that means is there's not revenue sharing amongst the clubs the way that there is amongst like NFL teams and MLB teams, all of this stuff. So like, if you're a net positive franchise in one of the four major US sports, you share revenue with the other less net positive franchises. And that kind of balances the books because you all work together and you're all doing that. USL doesn't work like that. It just has the game day experience. The USL, the only thing that goes towards the club is like the things that they sell, their merchandise, their tickets, things like that. They don't get revenue sharing. They split TV rights deals, I believe, with the league. I believe that one. I'm not positive about that. But so they don't get all of this money. So there is essentially a league, the USL, that kind of siphons money off of the top of these clubs. Whenever there's an expansion and there's a new franchise fee, that money all goes directly to USL. Like, you don't get, the Roots don't benefit from there being an expansion franchise the way that if there's an expansion franchise in MLB, that money gets, that huge revenue gets split amongst the teams. So that sort of business model is, I mean, this is me speaking personally, my opinion here, like a little bit unserious. In like a second division American soccer where revenue, where like, I don't know, margins are pretty slim and a lot of these teams are already operating at a loss. To have a league that just kind of takes money off of the top of that kind of largely, like, does not help the health of this league seriously. So when you have a league that's a little bit, it has an almost adversarial relationship with their clubs, like there's a reason that USL just lets their teams fold all the time. It doesn't matter to them. They can just get an expansion. They can just get an expansion team. That expansion fee goes to the league. So kind of no skin off their back. But it is skin off of then your players' backs. Like when you're North Carolina FC and you're in the middle of a playoff run and all of a sudden your players who maybe had a contract going into next year or had like the chance of getting a contract picked up and maybe expected to don't have a club to play at next year and they're all of a sudden unemployed. I think that's like a real tension in this negotiation that's like kind of hard to overcome. So it leads me to not be super optimistic. But at the same time, I do maybe think it's hard to see a labor stoppage coming in this particular context. Maybe yeah. The players don't feel like they have the most leverage in this
situation. I was going to say.
Situation.
It's hard to know who has more leverage here.
I think that players feel maybe some optimism that like there is like the World Cup soccer wave that USL is relying on here, and that like their ability to kind of throw a wrench in things now at this particular time is like a little bit advantageous for them.
Yeah.
Is the threat of a strike or a lockout?
We are less than 2 months away from the contract coming together, and they've made very little progress. I am a person who's generally not inclined to believe if little movement happens for a long time that all of a sudden movement will happen.
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. My experience in negotiation is that nothing happens till the deadline. That's why you have the deadline.
That's right. Yeah. Is there really enough revenue in the USL to support a business model like MLB, NBA, NFL? I see your point about
the answer
how,
has always been no. That's why like Major League Soccer is a single entity model, which is like a little bit different. Like Major League Soccer, everything is Major League Soccer. It's not like independent franchises that own the league. The league owns everything. They're just Major League Soccer.
Well, I wonder, I understand your point that it is like it exposes the players to the risk of their club folding. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wonder if like, because I feel like what the USL has capitalized on, what it has turned into like 15 years of success as a league, is that like it can take on these independent clubs that exist when NISA folds or NISA turns into garbage or, you know, an NASL, you know, wherever like the, you know, all the teams that left that abandoned the Cosmos. And it's like, and so, yeah, part of the USL's model is the fact that they can tell their big clubs like Sacramento, like Louisville, you're not going to suffer if Reno folds. You know, you're safe to invest as much as you want to try to build this fan base because it's like, it's you're not bearing the brunt of this risk. And so I don't know. And it's kind of like, as a fan, it's sort of hard to know where the roots sit in that, because the stadium situation is precarious. But as markets go, you know, Oakland is second to none in the USL.
And as investment goes, it seems to be pretty heavy.
Yeah, and just in terms of the population that lives within an easy drive of wherever the Roots decide to play, like, no one else has anything close. I don't know, Orange County, but
yeah, I think if you're counting the large markets adjacent to the specific markets, yeah, Orange County probably is the biggest. But I mean, like, that's kind of the sandbox the Roots get to be playing in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess that expansion that they reach into is like, has been, you know, in their past, like on the backs of like paying players like insanely small amounts of money, right? Like, you know, like $600 monthly paychecks. We're talking before the first CBA.
Well, all right. That's certainly something to keep an eye on. As if there wasn't enough movement on the Roots home front to keep an eye on, it gets to be a particularly active offseason around here. As we go into it with no coach, it's unclear how many players are coming back. We talked just last episode about there are a lot of bright spots and yet obvious areas for improvement. And I think what maybe is so frustrating about everything is we just watch these playoffs unfold, and obviously they're not finished as we record. You know, we're recording before the semifinals or the conference finals rather. And all the best teams are out. Like, it's by which I mostly mean Louisville and Charleston. But it's just another data point in just get into the playoffs. You know, is it the Mariners GM who says you're aiming for an 84 win season, and then you just know that normal variance means every once in a while you win 94 games, you get into the playoffs, and anything can happen. I mean, it seems like it's even more true in this league. So the big questions, yeah, who should be coming back? What should this team start to look like next year? And let's start at the top, John. I mean, we really just have rumors and speculation to go on as far as the coaching search goes. But what are those rumors and what can we speculate?
Well, the marquee rumor is Ryan Martin is the guy for Oakland. I reported that there was interest there. I think some pretty concrete interest. There's writing on the wall that he's the guy. We can even talk about the USL show guys. They know some things, and they would be surprised. You know, they were talking about some of the other jobs that have opened up around the league. James Chambers from Colorado Springs gets fired. Big surprising move. That's an attractive job. But they would be surprised if things change with Ryan Martin. I think that means that Martin knows where he's going, and if everything is correct, he's coming here. And I think I've talked about this. I talked about this with Daniel Poulter on his podcast. I think we talked about it a little bit on here on our last recording. I think it'd be a great hire. I think he's a guy with a lot to prove. He's coming from Loudoun, which it's hard to say what kind of support he was getting over the years. They had some changes in ownership starting in 2023 that really started to take effect in 2024, which, correct me if I'm wrong, they missed the playoffs, but there were some signs of life there. They were really competing in the early portion, mid portion of the season, and then maybe their roster woes caught up to them. This year they made the playoffs, so the first time in its history. So yeah, they didn't make it in 2024, but he's had to work with not a lot of backing, and you look at Oakland Roots and the roster they put together for 2025, and you know, I've talked about on the record that the payroll has changed with Oakland Roots. You can see that in the profile of player that is now coming through the doors now. And I think Ryan Martin would look at that and say, wow, that's really attractive. I mean, to me, I think I look at Roots, I look at the quality of their training facilities, the quality of pitch that they're playing on, and it is a very attractive job. It might be the best job in the league right now. Colorado Springs included.
Oh, that's a bold statement.
Is it? I mean, it is USL. I mean,
fair. Top but of the league. Colorado Springs has been a slightly more established track record.
Yeah. You know, they have a nice stadium, which I believe is turf, though.
I think you're right. Yeah.
But I can't speak to their training facility in Colorado Springs. I just know that Roots are the only team playing at a former NFL headquarters. So
I wonder if you're a head coach in the USL, how much you care about prior success at the clubs you're looking at, because roster turnover can be so significant. And
I think that's a great point. I'm only using it sort of as a proxy for stability.
For likely investment. Yeah. But that's why, I mean, I feel like if you're a head coach, you probably know what the Roots spent on the roster last year. We can only speculate. So if you're the Roots head coach and you know that was an expensive roster, or you're a head coach looking at the Roots job, you know that roster was expensive, and you're like, well, shit, I'll hire the guys that'll actually perform for that money. I know I can win there.
The Roots seem like desperate to invest in someone. Like they do. So like, I don't know. That's probably kind of appealing. Like they're just like, I don't know. They're desperate for something to, I don't know. Maybe I don't know this for sure, but it just feels like they should probably be desperate for somebody to take them and make them a good soccer team.
We would like them to be as desperate as we are.
Yeah. Like someone, there should be some desperation.
I feel that there is, you know, I feel that they are looking to, change the guard, so to speak. You know, all these swing after swing after swing after swing after swing after swing on coaches who have little experience in the role. You know, Benny Fellhaber was the only head coach in Oakland Roots history who held a head coaching role before his post in Oakland. So I think with Ryan Martin, that is a clear sign of change. Like, look, guys, we need to start taking some more calculated risks. You know, I think
Ryan Martin's probably like desperate to be invested in after the like really slugging it out for like as like the DC United's a poorly run MLS team, and he was their like second coach.
Yeah, I mean, I think he also fits into what Roots are looking for, someone who has a track record with developing young talent. Yeah, developing young talent specifically. You know, I think of, you know, we know how important Project 510 is to this organization. Someone like Ali Al-Masnawi is in the long-term vision of this club. You know, they need someone who is going to develop these players and understands how important the pipeline is from academy to first team to sell on to bigger and better places. So, you know, I would be excited about Ryan Martin. I think he's who we can expect, barring some crazy changes. You never know with this league. There are some jobs that opened up since I reported that there was interest in him. So, you know, time will tell, but I think we're on the horizon of a hire.
Didn't like 1,000 Turkish players and coaches get suspended or banned in that betting scandal?
Yeah, so some huge number.
We probably have our pick of Turkish coaches right now. Well, admittedly, Turkish coaches who allegedly cheat.
If you're not cheating, you're not trying.
I just think I think it might be worth maybe pause the coaching search domestically to see who your options are internationally. This is the Roots retaining a lawyer to advise on whether we extradite to Turkey.
You never know with this administration either whether betting on your facilitating prop bets on your own game would be.
It's the only way you can actually currently get a visa. Yeah.
That's right. Ryan Martin would be, as you say, John, it'd be a different approach in that we're finally looking at someone with a track record of being a head coach. But I think you sort of alluded to it there. This is still a guy whose background is in developing players. You know, he was the Loudoun head coach for so many years when it was the DC United Academy squad. He was the academy director for DC United before that. And prior to that, he had also been under 23 coach for the Columbus Crew and an assistant at Wake Forest. And he's also the son of the winningest D3 soccer coach in history.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For whom he played at Ohio Wesleyan, whose mascot is the Battling Bishops.
That's right.
Just had to get it in there.
Is that the first Battling Bishops reference on Roots Pod?
I think it is the first Battling Bishops reference, okay. Yeah.
They battle primarily in a diagonal direction.
Oh, boy.
I
think going in that direction still signals something, maybe signals something about how they're thinking about allocating, player funds next year, assuming we get there, right? Like this year, there were some big swings on more established talent, and most of them missed. It does suggest maybe they kind of want to go back to their roots and be like, let's find guys who, you know, who have some potential who can be molded. So that'll be interesting to watch. There probably should be movement on that soon, because John, you were able to report on these rumors near the end of the season, and also I think we were able to glean from the way things have unfolded from public statements that they have been looking, this search more or less started when they hired Failhaber. Like they knew that they needed to go in a different direction. And so the legwork has been done. And also I think there's an awareness that they need to have a guy in here right from the beginning of the off season, more or less the beginning of the off season, when these decisions start to get made about who you're going to sign and where players are going to play. And, so we should probably expect movement on that soon.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that is refreshing to see, right? I mean, I think back to, almost all of the coaching hires and things dragged on. You know, Guerra was hired a bit late in the window. He was hired right before New Year's Day. Even Noah dragged on a bit. Gavin didn't drag on because I think that decision was made. He was already under contract. They could announce it very quickly. So with Ryan Martin, it does, you know, they've done legwork. It shows some intent. It shows that we're looking for a clear structure, doing things by the book, cleaning up the sloppiness, and, you know, hopefully that pays off. So we'll see when, overturn starts to happen with the roster. I think contract options are usually announced or at least decided on 2 days after the final. And then I believe contracts toll, so contracts end for players on December 1st. So that's usually kind of the timeline.
And you put a little legwork into trying to figure out who might still be under contract, who might have an option, whether player or team for next year. So why don't we, like, as we start to think about what next year's team looks like, let's start there. Based on what little public reporting there is, who are we likely to see on the roster next year? Or rather, who would be on the roster if, do we think, if nothing changes? Like, all things being equal, who are we likely to see there? Understanding that options might get declined, players might get, you know, released, whatnot, but baseline, what are we looking at?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know for certain who is under an additional year and who is under an option year. You can assume most players have an option on their deal. So, I mean, you think of going back to last year's initial roster announcement, players that were under contract coming back were Gagi,
Riley,
Hackshaw. Actually, Hackshaw's agent announced that he got a long-term extension. We'll see what that means. I have heard some mixed things on his viability for next year. Peter Wilson said himself that he has a contract for 2026. I think from what I've heard, it's an option. If it's an additional year,
that'd be my preference. That up, damn it.
Oh yeah, pick that up in a heartbeat. There's no way. Sorry, Peter, if you miss your wife, you got to play for us next year, man. You signed the contract.
Brutal.
You can't win a golden boot and not come back. You made your bet on that one. Panos Armanakis.
Swedish teams want to pay us $1 million for Peter Wilson. That's a deal. Firm handshake. We appreciate your service.
Do you think it would take Roots $1 million to sell him? Usually these days it's like, oh, you know, Roots will sell someone like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I have my doubts about the Roots negotiating strategies generally, but yeah, probably wouldn't take $1 million. I just, you know, I picked a number that I felt safe saying. If someone was willing to pay it, I would not be upset.
Another player, Wolfgang Prentiss, signed an extension during the season, so you can expect him back. After that, it's a little murky. We know that Daniel Gomez was playing under an option year, so he should be set to be a free agent. After that, I mean, you're looking at a lot of new players, so it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. Going back to a player that was already on the roster, Gagi, we can assume he played out a contract year. He's going to be entering an option year, so they have a decision there. Kai Green was a player that was signed during the offseason. It's hard to say if they got a 1 year plus an option or 2 years plus an option. You know, I would think that that's an interesting negotiating tactic to give someone a little more stability. You know, Roots are obviously going against the grain in some respect, you know, throughout their history. Do they sign these players to 2 year deals with an option just to, you know, give them a little long term stability? So yeah, there's a lot of choices on the table that we have to talk about here and who you guys would like to see back.
Well, and to finish that, I believe you said that you understand that all of the guys who came mid-season were on contracts that just ran to the end of the season. So Donor, Patash, Trejo, and there's a fourth, right? Okay, maybe just those three. There's no ongoing contractual relationship with any of those guys. So. Unfortunately, I would say the second, third, and fourth names on my list for who I would bring back next season.
Those guys. Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe The interesting question. Well, let's see. I mean, if you go down the list by non-penalty goal contributions per 90, Trejo, Wilson, Batash, sure. Wolfgang, great. And then the fifth is Jürgen Damm, who I assume we're all in agreement should be nowhere near the city of Oakland, perhaps the state of California for the foreseeable. Good riddance there. Camden Riley, who has retired. Rasmussen, who didn't finish the season with the team. Maury Doner.
He's sixth.
He is seventh.
Like a half, not even half the season.
Well, I guess if it's per 90.
It's a per 90. Yeah, this is a rate stat. Never,
so that's literally just his bicycle kick.
That is correct. One goal in 352 minutes. That was his.
And it was the goal of the year.
Cool, yeah.
Cool.
Good for him. Good for him.
Then it's Maury Doner, Daniel Gomez, Jose Luis Sinisterra, who unfortunately is also, if he wants to come back, that'd be great. But obviously we don't blame him if he would like to stay in the friendly confines of anywhere that is not the United States. And then you get to the really interesting questions, I think. Panos. Let me throw that out.
Tough one.
Tough one. Right? Feel like this is the big swing because we've seen in previous years that he is a very capable USL level player, probably on a good day, fringe MLS, and didn't show it last year. And also, we know he has some issues with the cost of healthcare in California, which, I mean, fair.
So, I mean, that's an interesting subject. You go back to the offseason and Panos's agent wrote on Twitter that he got a 2-year contract. So I've heard some things with Panos. It's hard to say if he'll come back. If he's not, then that would entail that it's a release by mutual consent. So that might be something to keep an eye on. Also, if it is Ryan Martin, we know that they have experience together at Loudoun. Can those ties mend the bridge there? But hard to say. I have heard some unhappiness from his camp. So it's hard to say what will happen. I mean, he is a very, very, very talented guy. It's fun to watch him when the ball is at his feet. But if he doesn't want to be here, he doesn't want to be here.
I don't feel like his performance this season makes me regret it if he leaves. But knowing the player he was before this season and knowing that it will be a different head coach, I like won't be mad if he's back. If they, you know, I don't even think I would be mad if that takes into account the fact that he's like probably the highest paid player on the team. Like, he was a good player previously. There's a decent chance he will be a good player again with a different manager whose system he works in better. So I could really go either way on it. And I don't think I'm going to be upset either way.
I think it says a lot that Phil Huber put him in as an outside back because it shows one, he thought he needed to be on the pitch. Right, and that's a good thing. And he wanted him to be on the pitch in a place where his creativity could make a difference. But he didn't think that could be in the position that I had a sort of assumed was his natural position because it's where we've seen him play in the past. And you know, it's one of those things like in American football, a position change usually signals a huge issue, and it's hard to know. I think there's some ambiguity in it. Was the issue that sort of caused this position change on Panos's part, just his inability to fit into the system? Are we seeing just that he was in systems that in a he needs to be in a different kind of system to thrive, or was it was the issue on the Roots part that just the defensive and the attacking phases of play were just sort of disjointed and a guy of his skill set in the middle of the pitch was just not, that's not what the Roots needed. How that question gets answered behind the scenes, assuming, again, there are no other off the field, you know, locker room type issues that the team wants to work through or feels like need to be dealt with. But I think how that question gets answered in the background would tell us a lot, one, about how this team is going to approach building the roster, and two, whether they bring this guy back. Next on the list, and this is another interesting, Julian Bravo.
You know what's funny is I felt like there were games where he seemed really good and like he was improving. And then there were games where it felt like he was stagnant, and then he was gone, never heard from again. And that just, it seems like a really strange arc. I mean, except as to say that like Failhaber played him for several games and then we never saw him again. And I don't know, especially because our left back position was so terrible that Benny ultimately decided it was better to simply not play a left back. Like, that there was no difference between having no defensive left back at all and running Julian Bravo out. And that is like that's a pretty damning criticism. But I don't know. He never struck me as like the problem or the worst player on the pitch, you know?
They didn't seem to trust him as a center back, which it seemed like he kind of thought he was going to be. He's big. And I don't know. He's not the most exciting left back in the world. He's kind of, because he's big and bulky and
yeah. Well, you're right about it being a center back. I mean, I think we all had this comment after the first couple of games. You're like, he looks the part of a center back. He carries himself on the pitch. He's the right size. But you're right, it never came together. And he's young, which I think is the reason this is interesting. If we'd gotten that season from someone who was 30. And God, it pains me to say that because, you know, I'm going to have trouble standing up after we record this. But, you know, if that is understood generally to be, you know, on the back half of a professional athletic career, it'd be one thing. But he's much younger and there's obvious. Mm-hmm.
I imagine for his career, he's probably interested in moving somewhere where he's definitively going to play more. I would imagine. Yeah. Wherever that means.
Yeah, it's hard to say with him. I think he is a more of a depth option. I mean, he is young. I view him as a center back. He was signed as a center back. I think he was played at left back out of necessity. Is he a starter? Probably not. Maybe his salary kind of indicates that as well. But you know, Roots probably have an option on him to decide on. I'd be a little surprised if you sign him to a multi-year deal, but I mean, if he is cheap and you do need the depth, I mean, I could see him back, but it probably still entails that you need some pretty big additions at the center back spot.
Well, and that's where this would go next, right?
Here we go.
Next on the list are Hackshaw, Gagge, and I'll jump a little bit, and then you get Kai Greene. And really, the question is, does anyone from the defense come back?
I love Gagge, man.
I agree. But if it's just, as a unit, it underperformed, do you try to salvage something from that, or do you just say, whoa, we got to start over?
Go ahead.
So, okay. I probably vote, setting aside any questions of contract situation, I would start from scratch with the defense. You know, if you could just start entirely from scratch without costing yourself money, I do that. Now, the exception is Gagge, as Jack mentioned, but I think that then the question is, right, because Gagge is like two different players. One of them is good and one of them is bad.
When Gagino comes out, it's special.
Okay? And I think
the braids, he's got super
cornrow. Gagge gets +5 all stats. All right.
I asked the new head coach, and it's like, is this a guy you want? If you think that the risk is worth it, I mean, he's by far our most athletic center back in some ways. He is, he pulls out the most incredible pieces of technical skill. I would say technically Hackshaw is our best center back, like with the ball at his feet. And it's, I don't know, but it's like if Ryan Martin is like, fuck yeah, let's play the roll the dice center back game. That's what Nagy is coming back.
That's what Benny did. Benny showed up and was like, dude, hell yeah, this is great. He's going to touch the ball all the time in the middle of the field.
Yeah. But the, I, otherwise, I just rebuild it. I don't know. I feel like, I've said this before, I have felt like the biggest thing that has hamstrung this team is that they have needed Hackshaw's passing and Hackshaw's heading of the ball, and everything else in the defense is built around trying to patch the hole that is created by the fact that Hackshaw can't run. And so we end up running, like, frequently that has meant running five defenders. Under Failhaber, it meant we ran four defenders and conceded three goals a game. And it's just like, there's just no, I feel like you have to just start over and be like, we're going to do this with two center backs that we think play center back well.
And maybe none of them have like a fatal flaw that we have to cover. Maybe they're just a little more collectively USL level.
Honestly, like find two guys who are B minuses in everything.
Yeah.
Instead of a couple of guys who have a D plus in one category.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you, Peter. I think it's the spot that you need to hit the reset button. I think that the defense, the back line really, the cracks really showed, especially down the stretch. I mean, we know Ryan Martin is a highly possessive coach, likes to play out of the back. And there were some mistakes in between Kai Green and Hackshaw and Gagi playing out of the back. So I think it's obviously difficult to replace three players, let alone four players, if you're getting rid of Bravo too. So maybe one of those three come back. Kai Green just signed a contract last offseason. Maybe he has a two-year deal. Hard to say. Hackshaw's agent announced he got a long-term deal. If he's not on the roster, maybe that means by mutual consent. But, you know, hard to say. But yeah, for me, I think that is the marquee position that you need to hit the reset button on. And because, you know, rest of the roster, there's actually some pretty nice pieces that you can build around. But are there those, you know, pieces at the center back spot? I don't really think so.
All right. Very quickly, relatedly, the only other real position we haven't covered, defensive central midfield, if Bobosi, if Tyler Gibson.
I feel not strongly about anybody who's not Ali Al-Masnawi coming back.
Oh, I bring Bobosi back.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah. I bring Bobosi back. Ali's obviously back. I think Ali is, man, I wouldn't be upset at him starting next year. Gibson, I think it's I think you can turn the page pretty comfortably there. But I like what I saw from Bobosi, especially that last game of the season, just that amazing run down the right side. He made some nice passes, and he likes to take a shot from 30 yards, so he's fun to watch.
All right. We will put a bow in the roster discussion right there then. I just because I've been laughing about this to myself most of the day. We are recording on a day on which several thousand emails from the estate of Jeffrey Epstein were released. And I don't want to take away from the top line, the headline ones, but there's one email in there which he wrote to himself. Subject: forward radical breakthrough, which includes like 33 deep thoughts that this guy felt the need to email to himself. Let me just give you a taste of this. 7, skin is part of brain membrane. I'm just dying over here. Beards and long hair, comma, are meant to catch and hold smells, period, question mark. Getting a lot of nods here on that one. Writing is unnatural, asymmetric, speed, not good for everyone. Linear, slow, rule-based.
Wait, what? What's the alternative? What?
6, nose test, telepathy. I swear to God. 10, does the eye transmit information?
How is I being spelled there?
EYE.
Okay. This isn't like a deeply philosophical question.
Do we learn by seeing?
Maybe we do. Questions equals AI to the minus one.
No.
This is incredible stuff. Anyway, the top lines, the ones that are covered in the news, obviously much more important. But 18, power laws and probability, gravity, is, I think, equally important to get out there. Anyway.
I seriously considered updating my work email signature this morning to say all caps, do not repeat this insight. I may have never seen anything in an email I liked better than that.
All right. That's enough of a detour. The Oakland Roots, a lot of decisions coming up. I guess it should be noted, there is one Oakland Roots alum left in the USL playoffs at the time of recording, and it's Travian Sousa.
Like we all predicted.
Playing for FC Tulsa. So, you know, I think most of us probably have zero dog in the fight amongst the remaining teams, given how unlikely they all were to reach this spot in the playoffs. So I don't know. For me, I think I'm just going to be pulling for Tulsa because of the Roots connection.
I don't hate any of the remaining teams.
I can't believe how much I don't hate any of them.
It's like, totally like neutral on all of them.
I would say geographically, Tulsa, probably my least favorite of those four locations. I haven't been, but I have a feel. I mean, I watch election results. Rhode Island, Pittsburgh, New Mexico, all fine with me if they win at all.
I want New Mexico because someone at the team very much disagreed with my want to have Dennis Sanchez as head coach. So yeah, go New Mexico.
All right. Well, there you have it. Okay. More news may or may not happen by the time we record next, but if something does, we'll be sure to talk about it extemporaneously for 5 or 10 minutes longer than anyone wants us to.
Really a surprising amount of time.
All right. Until then, up the Roots.